listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Lionel Shriver is a novelist whose previous books include the Orange Prize winner We Need to Talk About Kevin, which relives the trauma of a school massacre, The Post-Birthday World, A Perfectly Good Family, which her mother misremembers as a perfect family, Game Control, Double Fault, The Female of the Species, Checker and the Derailers, and Ordinary Decent Criminals. She is widely published as a journalist, writing features, columns, op-eds, and book reviews for The Guardian, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. Her new novel, So Much for That, could not be more timely. It tells the story about the strain placed on a marriage when catastrophic illness intrudes. Imagine a novel that embraces healthcare in America. It's really quite extraordinary. All of her novels probe deep questions about love, death, and life's purposes, and this one explores one of the most provocative questions of all: how much is one human life worth? I love this review of her new novel, So Much for That, which came out today in the Washington Post. If Jodi Picoult has her finger on the zeitgeist, Shriver has her hands around its throat. Not only does her new book wrestle with actual laws and prices, COBRA, copays, out-of-network deductibles, but it reminds us just how politically argumentative a novel can be. She makes us consider the most existential questions of our lives and the dreadful calculus of modern healthcare in this country. If the senators so enamored of our current insurance industry conduct their threatened filibuster, perhaps some strong stomach Democrat should counter by reading this story into the congressional record, which I think would be a very good idea. If you read the Los Angeles Times, and I hope you do, you'll know that Megan Daum's distinctly wise and funny voice from her columns. She writes a weekly opinion column for The Times. She's written it since 2005. She's the author of the essay collection My Misspent Youth and the novel The Quality of Life Report, which was a New York Times notable book. And her articles and essays have appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times. Her new book, a narrative nonfiction work about real estate addiction, is called Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House, and it's coming out later this spring. Please welcome Lionel Shriver and Megan Daum. Thank you.
My reading this evening you can just take as my rehearsal for reading the entire book into the congressional record. So Much for That is about a man named Shep Necker, and he saved his whole life to cut and run. He wants to leave the rat race in New York and start a new life, what he calls the afterlife, in the third world. Because if you save your pennies in the West, they will last probably for the rest of your life. He and his wife, Glynis, have spent their 26-year marriage going on regular, what they call, research trips, looking for the perfect place to decamp to. But as the book begins, my friend Shep has finally realized that his wife Glynis is not serious about leaving the United States behind. She's continually come up with one reason or another why now is not the right time to go, or that is not the right country. So he presents her with an ultimatum. He has bought 3 plane tickets for her, for himself, and for their son, Zach. They are one way. They are from a week hence. Now, he tells her that she can come with him or not, but he's going with her without her, because this is an act of loyalty to himself. This is what he's always planned to do his entire life. And his wife doesn't seem very affected by this announcement. In fact, she seems bemused. And that's because she has an announcement of her own. She's just been diagnosed with cancer. So Shep can't leave. This is the perfect thing to keep him home. He's a good man. He's not going to leave his wife with a deadly illness. She needs him emotionally, but even more, she needs his health insurance. For the rest of the novel, Shep's savings for the afterlife are steadily eroded to nothing because of all the things that health insurance doesn't cover. Now, this is not an exclusive comment on American healthcare. I realize that people who buy novels want to read stories about characters, and they want to read about larger issues than passing political foo-foo-rahs like health insurance reform in Congress. So it does take on some pretty big issues that aren't going anywhere anytime soon, no matter what Congress passes, like illness and death. The passage I want to read to you this evening is in the latter part of the book. Glynis is not doing very well, and one of the difficulties that Shep has with her illness is not just the fact that she's probably going to die, but the fact that she refuses to admit it. It's alienating. It injects an artifice in their relationship, and it means that he can't talk about his future without her. Now, there's not really much else you need to know to understand this passage. Aside from the fact that Glynis has recently had a visit from her best friend Petra, it didn't go very well. "By the way," said Zach, nodding at the rosemary chicken thighs that Shep had just pulled out of the toaster oven, "Mom says no chicken. She's sick of it." Shep took a deep breath. He was tired. But among the many rights he had abdicated since Glynis's diagnosis in January was the right to be tired. He put the chicken aside to cool. What Glynis was and wasn't sick of changed on a dime, and by tomorrow the chicken might appeal. He found some ground sirloin patties in the freezer and carefully defrosted them in the microwave on 20% power, turning them after every 60 seconds. He fried the meat. She liked it rare. He arranged Glynis's tray. Trying to make the spread more tantalizing, he picked some sprigs of ivy from the porch creeper and put them in with some water in a hand-painted crystal vase from their trip to Bulgaria. He delivered the tray, then retrieved his own plate to eat in the chair beside her. He wondered idly if he should be aggrieved that his wife didn't ever ask after his plans after... And then he stopped. After what? How could they ever talk about after when they never got to the what? Glynis was once more glued to the food channel. It was what she kept on most of the time now. He might have found her fixation on cooking shows more encouraging had the amount of food she watched not been inversely proportional to the amount she ate. "You know what floors me," she said, not yet touching the food, which would soon get cold. "It's the way people expect me to have some kind of answer, as if I must have discovered the big secret, and I'm supposed to come across with a blinding vision, a cloud-parting revelation from on high. Shit, on top of chemo and chest drains and MRIs, I'm supposed to part the waters for everyone else. It's fucking unreasonable. It's outrageous, really. I mean, what a burden to dump on someone who already feels like cat puke. What's the meaning of life? How have you changed? How does everything look from there? Now that you've seen the light, tell us what's really important." Christ, I'm sick. I'm not running an ashram. Just like my mother, everyone wants something from me. And then when I don't come across, I'm a big disappointment. I'm made to feel inadequate just because I can't crawl to the bathroom for an enema, choke down 50 pills an hour, and recite the Gutenberg Bible at the same time. I can see how it might seem like an imposition, said Shep. But I can also see how people might think you could tell them something about what it's like to face down something they never have. Well, they'll have to get their fucking salvation somewhere else. The Church of Glynis Knacker is closed for refurbishment. Finally, she took a bite. What did you do to the rice? She asked irritably, as a chirpy girl on TV cracked a raw egg onto steak tartare and made a joke about salmonella. I cooked it in chicken broth, he said. I thought that would make it more nutritious. Substituting broth for water was an idea he'd picked up from the Food Channel. Tastes awful. I don't like it. She pushed the plate to the edge of the tray. I'd rather have plain. All right, he said patiently, picking up the tray. I'll make some plain then. He left his own meal to get cold. Downstairs, he scraped the offending rice back into the pot. He boiled more rice. When the rice finished steaming, he allowed it to rest, the way it said to in the joy of cooking. He placed pats of butter over the top, half a stick or more, then fluffed the grains with a fork. He microwaved her plate, again at 20% power to keep them from overcooking the beef, and returned to the bedroom. She took one bite of the new rice and chewed for a long time. That would be all she ate of the rice. This was par for the course. Lately, she was prone to make very specific and sometimes obscure requests for a dish that she was craving, and nothing else would do. He always fulfilled her wishes. The last request was for Chinese sesame noodles, which absolutely had to be from Empire Sichuan in Manhattan. Fetching the takeout on the way home from work had cost him 2 hours in rush hour traffic. She'd eaten one bite of the noodles, too. He thought he understood. The idea of food grew ever more enticing as the reality of food grew ever more vile. You don't think I'm doing this right, do you? Said Glynis, when she'd shoved the barely touched plate to the far edge of the tray a second time. Doing what? You know, she croaked. I'm supposed to be gracious, philosophical, kind, loving and magnanimous and brave. Think I don't know the drill? I'm supposed to be like that little girl in Uncle Tom's Cabin. What's her name? Nell. Selfless schlock. Nobody's asking you to do anything or to be any particular way. Bullshit! You think I don't know, but I know what you think, what Petra thinks, what everyone thinks when they think about me at all, which is, she coughed, hardly ever. On top of everything else, I'm supposed to have cancer. Well. Just getting through the day is having cancer well. Oh, what a load of crap. That's one of those soft, blah lines. I can't stand it. I feel as if I'm trapped in a top 40 by the Carpenters. Look at Petra. She used to fight her corner. Now she comes over and it's like having a visit from a vanilla pudding. I can say anything. Your work stinks. You're a hack. She just takes it. What do you people think I've become? Sick, that's all. That means it's not you but everyone else who's supposed to be kind. gracious, like you said. Kind. It's not kind to treat me like some evil queen who'll cut your head off if you don't always tell her she's the fairest in the land. And you're the worst. You never even get mad at me anymore. You don't call me on anything. I can hurl any abuse I want, like Linda Blair spewing green pus. All I hear back is, "That's lovely green pus, Glynis. Now why don't you wait till I wipe this off, and then I'll plump your pillows." You're so endlessly fucking nice. It makes me sick. All the niceness, it makes me even sicker. You've always been a pushover. But now you're well on your way from worm to grub. In sloshing her hand across the tray on grub, she upset the vase with the ivy. Its neck shattered against the plate. The water spilled into the food and over the sheet. Shep put his own plate aside. He nimbly picked the shards of glass from the bed and then from the carpet. "I'll get you some fresh sheets," he promised.
"Look at you! Now you're literally on your knees. What's wrong with you? Why don't you say, 'Glynis, you stupid cunt'? Why don't you say, 'Glynis, clean it up yourself'? I just called you a grub. What do I get in response? 'I'll get you some fresh sheets.' You're not even a grub. A grub has more guts. You've turned into some kind of amoeba."
He stood and picked up the tray. "Glynis, you're tired, that's all."
"Tired? I'm always tired. So what?"
There was rice on the sheets. Though they were fresh from 2 days ago, drying them would not suffice. He would have to wash them. "Glynis, I don't know what you want from me."
"That's what I mean. It's always what I want. Don't you want anything anymore? You've disappeared. You're not even there. You're a service provider. You could be replaced with a good Japanese robot."
"Glynis, why are you trying to hurt me?" God, that was a relief. Just a tiny glimmer of self-defense, just a smidgen, a soupçon, a pinch. She flicked a grain of rice on the sheet with her thumb and forefinger, but couldn't marshal enough propulsive strength, and the grain stuck to her finger.
"But to answer your question, I'll hurt you because you're the only person I can get my hands on. And maybe to check if you've got any feelings to hurt."
"I have lots of feelings, Glynis."
Yet his delivery was stoic. With the many subjects she avoided, her future, not to mention her lack of future, he often felt deprived of all she didn't tell him. So perhaps she might also sense and resent all that he didn't tell her.
"You ask me what I want?" she snarled. "I want someone who wants. You never even fuck me anymore."
He was surprised. "I've assumed you weren't up for it."
"Screw what you think I'm up for. Want something for yourself."
"All right," he said. "I'll try."
"More of the same. Compliance. So you will try to ravish me. You will try to rape me. In the same spirit, you will try to get me more cranberry juice. Compliance. Nothing but compliance. Do you think that's sexy?"
He was not sure how to manage this. She was in a very volatile humor. He did not want to make everything worse. But if he tried too hard not to make everything worse, he'd put his foot in it with his very carefulness and make everything worse. "I'm supposed to feel bad for being too good?" Though the very tentativeness of his tone might have inflamed her further, she shook her turbaned head in what looked like pity. Look, you're amazing. The tirelessness, the patience, the unflagging devotion, never a harsh word, never a complaint. Working at that shitty job and caring for me morning to night, or more like night to morning. Any day now, I expect to see your photograph on the cover of Time. But I don't want a paragon. I want a husband. I miss you. I don't know where you went. I think you're the same man who announced a little less than a year ago that he was moving to East Africa with or without me. Where did that guy go, Shepherd? I want a human being. I want a man who has limits, who sometimes gets cranky, who sometimes feels resentful, if not homicidal. A real man who at least occasionally gets pissed off. He thought hard. I got pissed off with my sister. 20 years too late, too. But I mean me. I want you to get pissed off with me. I refuse to believe that all this schlepping and fetching and schmoeing is not driving you crazy. All right. He was still standing, holding the tray, regrettably a pose of servitude. I didn't like it very much. He would have to start again. Glynnis was right. The very vocabulary of such discourse was vanishing from his head. I was annoyed when you asked for different rice. Bravo, Glynnis taunted. It was hard to remember how people talked to each other, well people, spouses, how he used to talk to Glynnis. I was annoyed because I knew that if I went to the trouble of making another pot, you wouldn't eat more than a mouthful. That's right. She did seem strangely gratified, and all he'd had to say was that he'd been put out. And that's all I did eat, wasn't it? Yes. And the rice made with broth. I'd noticed the preparation on TV. I'd remembered to buy the broth at the A&P. I was only trying to make the rice a little more interesting and better for you. Instead of thanking me, you punished me. You said the chicken broth rice tasted bad. That annoyed me too. Because the real story is that everything tastes bad. The real story is that instead of making rice at all, I could have mixed up a fresh batch of cement. It's all cement to you, and that isn't my fault. It would make a big difference to me if you were sometimes a little more appreciative of how hard I work to make you comfortable and to keep you alive. There now, said Glynnis. Was that so hard? Shep surprised himself. He started to cry. He had not cried since the night he read his wife's prognosis online. So he put the tray on the floor. He crawled onto the bed, lying on the wet part of the sheet. He rested his head on his wife's shrunken chest. She stroked his hair. She was probably not feeling very well, and that would be, as ever, a gross understatement. But for the first time in months, he had the impression that she was happy. It had never occurred to him that one of the things a woman made comfortable day in and day out might most have missed was doing the comforting.
Thank you. I had a million questions, and now I can't remember any of them. I have to say, when Louise called me and asked me if I would be interested in doing this event with you tonight, I immediately jumped because, as you know, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. I think, like a lot of people, I was introduced to your work with We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was 2003,
I believe.
That's when that came out. Okay. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, one of the things I think that for me and probably for a lot of people is most compelling about your work is that these are very much novels of ideas. Now, I know that's a cliche.
It sounds like a big turnoff, actually.
Yes. Well, exactly. As I sometimes I made the mistake of... I use the word essay too much, which you know you're never supposed to use. But at the risk of totally insulting you, they do feel sort of like essayistic novels in a sort of way, and in a very good way, as far as I'm concerned. Which is you're not only is there a really riveting plot and complicated characters and things happening. I mean, these are really page turners, but you're always working out a problem. You're asking a question, a set of questions, and trying to arrive at a set of answers. So I guess my first question for you is, what came first with this book? Was it the issue or the plot?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure. I don't remember what order my inspirations came, but certainly the... What moved me in the direction of writing about medical issues was the fact that a very close friend of mine was diagnosed at the age of 50 with mesothelioma. And that's the cancer that I smite Glynis with, unkindly, I might add. And my friend lasted about a year and 3 months after her diagnosis, which is par for the course with that illness. It moves very fast, and it's almost always diagnosed when it's too late because the symptoms don't show up until you've had it. And she died in late 2006. Now, there wasn't a large fiscal component of her story in that she was insured up the wazoo, and good that she was, too, because her treatment cost a total of $2 million. Which was also the figure that I used in the book, because I could count on it for being reliable. That treatment probably extended her life about 3 months, and I was around enough to be able to testify that they weren't a very good 3 months. And in spite of the fact that I loved her, I don't know whether that was worth $2 million in the big picture. And that was the initial inspiration for this novel. But in the sometime in there, and I don't remember when, I tripped across an article in the New York Times that was about the fact that the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country is medical bills. People outside the country think that we're all in debt or going bankrupt because, you know, we have... DVDs that record. That's not it. But what was especially staggering to me is that the majority of people who are going bankrupt from medical bills have health insurance. So I'm left with, what the hell is health insurance for then?
Now, I just want to orient us a little bit. You are an American, but you live in London.
Yes.
And you've lived there for a long time now.
Yeah, over 20 years.
Was your friend in the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, were you compelled to kind of take this on as an American, talking about an American problem, or did you see this as something that is more universal? Obviously, we tend to, some of us here tend to romanticize the healthcare system in other countries, and some of us demonize it. What do you say about
that?
The
big issues in this book are, they pertain to any Western country, and certainly they do pertain to the UK. It is asking this question of how much money do we want to expend on individual lives. That's something that the UK has to do. And in fact, they have a very unpopular organization there called NICE, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. And its job is to look at drugs and treatments, how much they cost, how much extra life or extra quality of life they buy, and they have a very strict formula. If a drug or a treatment does not pass that test, then the NHS will not finance it, you know. And we don't have any equivalent here. I guess that's the equivalent of the death panel. But actually, we need death panels, if that's what it is. You need some other agency that makes this determination, because you cannot expect people who are sick to say, I'm sorry, but I'm not worth that much money. Or you can't expect families to say, you know, our mother can be kind of a drag, so let's not spend all that money on her. It's actually an organization whose existence I admire.
So in the book, you do something interesting. You set up two different families. There's Shep and his wife, Glynis. Glynis is the one who's sick. And then there is Shep's friend and colleague, Jackson, who has a daughter named Flicka. And I want to talk about your names in a little bit, too. Who has a terrible, terrible degenerative disease called familial. What is the name of her disease?
Familial dysautonomia.
Is that a real disease?
It is a real disease.
Okay. Where did you come up with that illness? Can you talk a little bit about that family and what's going on with them and their sort of dynamic with Shep's family?
I went shopping for an illness. I wanted one that you weren't already over familiar with. Just on an entertainment value, I thought it would be more interesting if I found something weird out there and brought it to you.
She's a very funny character, I have to say. Like a cat going
foraging. And and this is a weird one. Only 350 people in the world have it. It's exclusively a Jewish genetic disease, and therefore almost all the people who do have it are in New York and Israel. That was convenient for me, so that when I started digging and came up with a couple families, I was in New York at the time, and they were local. It's a terrible disease. It affects the autonomic system, which is, I'd never heard of this before. It controls everything in your body that you don't have to think about. Only these kids have to think about it. And they take drugs for everything. It's a blood pressure, the temperature of your body. They can't even swallow naturally. They have to learn to swallow. Fold your epiglottis over. Do you ever think that when you eat? It's very hard on the parents because it's a full-time job taking care of these kids. And that particular character, though, I tried to, much as Glynis, as you can see, is not does not play the sweet, sick person of my friend Flicka, is not the sweet, disabled person. And rather than, be sunny and uncomplaining and thankful for every new day, Flicka is also pissed off and keeps telling her parents that she wishes she were dead.
Well, she's really the only one who's honest about that particular notion, and really the only one who uses that word. And in reading this, I thought a lot about the kind of fascination or the way we talk about dying well in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an oxymoron, and you sort of want it to make sense, but it's really very abstract. It's almost like one of these New Age equivocations. And I was wondering what you thought about that as you were writing along. Was that, how much of this was about death, and how much was it about medicine, if they can even be separated?
They can't be separated. Right. And yes, one of the things that the book does take on is, what does it mean to die well? And I think that's a hard one to answer, but it is involved with medicine. I think dying well involves finally getting medicine out of the picture, getting the doctors to leave you alone so you can get on with what you've got to do. But it also addresses the fact that, you know what, the only good thing about getting a terminal illness as opposed to being run over by a bus is that with this advance notice, you know, you can have encounters with the people who matter to you that with a sudden death you're not allowed. And that's what's really tragic about the fact that Glynis won't admit that she's dying, is that she's denying her family and friends these sayings of last things. I at least fancy there must be a kind of conversation you can have with people when you both acknowledge that it's going to be the last time you speak to each other. And I'm afraid that that's one way in which the medical establishment also denies us an opportunity to die well, because this business of, oh, you're going to be fine, or there's always another drug and another therapy, it's something that medical people encourage us to embrace. We're not ever supposed to say die, if you will. And that means that we're not really inhabiting our own deaths, right? Because we're in denial. And that means everyone else around us has to be in denial. And there's a richness, of encounter that we don't allow each other. And I think there's a loss there.
Well, it's all about hope. If you don't have hope, you're somehow betraying yourself and your family, or even your country in a way.
Yes, and doctors, I think, encourage people to believe that, you know, if you have a positive attitude, that it actually affects your survival rate. But the truth is, they have done studies of comparing populations. One group of people who were hopeful and thought that they were going to get better and were really out there fighting the good fight, and then the other population was dour and negative and figured they were going to die. And you know, the outcomes for those two populations are identical.
Did you happen to read Barbara Ehrenreich's book?
Haven't read that book yet, but it's really on my list. Yeah. Because she and I are definitely in agreement.
Well, there's a whole kind of kitsch around, especially certain kind of cancer. She's always written and talked a lot about the breast cancer and the teddy bears and the ribbons. And you know, it very much plays into the way that we kind of confuse the trappings of something with what's actually going on. And it may be a particularly American phenomenon. So, yes, you should read that book.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about the socioeconomic side of this novel. There's a lot of class issues that come up. Shep and Jackson, I think it's worth noting that they are handymen. Shep has sold, he owned his own company. He sold it for $1 million. That's how he has this portfolio, but he's still working for the company because he needs the insurance. And interestingly, Glynis is more of an effete person. She's an artist. She has a bit of a meandering, arcane career, but they're very much set up like he's the solid one and she's a little bit in the clouds. Why did you make that choice to make him a handyman?
You know, interestingly, I delayed the start of this book for months, just racking my brains, deciding what Shep did for a living. I take the careers of my characters very seriously, and I felt I really had to get this right. I wanted him to do something practical. I wanted him to be unpretentious. And I liked the modesty of the kind of business he starts. He starts out just being a handyman around New York, and there's such a demand for people who don't charge union wages that he soon starts hiring other handymen, and the business takes off. That's why he's able to sell it for $1 million, and that is the money that he wants to use for the afterlife. But I just liked the down-to-earth quality of the handyman business, and also it meant that he brushed up against the whole housing boom, which was a little bit sickening, really. I mean, that was it. I hit on it, and I think it suits him.
What were the other professions you considered for him?
I liked the idea of his having his own business. I just couldn't figure out what it was, and I didn't want it to be something. I didn't want it to be stupid, but I also didn't want it to be too up in the clouds. You know, I didn't want him to be an academic, anything like that. I wanted him to be a profoundly ordinary man. Shep is, you know, he's meant to be deliberately an everyman. And the other thing, I mean, you mentioned his relationship with his wife and economics. I was really hungry to write a book from a male perspective this time. I'd written a couple in a row from a woman's perspective. And I've always been very sympathetic with men who accept the conventional breadwinning role. A lot of women are resentful of that role, and you know, it's got a bad rep. But the truth is that if you are willing to take responsibility for earning all the money and supporting your entire family, that's not necessarily a privilege. That's a big burden, and I think that's. I'm glad that a lot of men have been relieved of that burden, and the men that do continue to do that, I think, are admirable.
One of the sort of side plots in the book has to do with Shep's relationship with the guy who bought his company, who's now his boss. And he talks a lot about how he can't afford to pay health benefits for the people he's now hired. And there's a great passage that I'm going to ask you to read from your page 250.
Let me find it.
Okay. I'll keep talking. You know, it's what's I think what's great about your work is that you really are. It's on the surface it could seem polemical almost, and there is a sort of thread of there's a real point of view, but you very much let in the other sides of the issue. It's sort of every side of the issue is represented by somebody or has a voice, and I think this is a really good example of that of that happening.
I think the key is just to keep it entertaining and at least occasionally amusing.
That too.
And it's amazing how much polemic you can include as long as it makes your reader smile. And this is Shep's boss, who used to be one of Shep's employees, so it's inverted. And I hire people, Pagachnik bullied on. I don't adopt them. Least of all do I adopt their whole goddamn families. You two, for now, I'm stuck with. But I'm telling you, this shit, this big communist cradle-to-grave employment shit, is over. It doesn't make any earthly sense that just because I take on an employee to clear other people's hairy drains, suddenly I'm supposed to pay for his ingrown toenails, the insulin for his diabetes because he eats too many Krispy Kreme Bavarian custards, his hernia operation after he bangs his squeeze on the side with too much gusto, his 10-year-old's ADD medication, if only because nobody admits to having a kid anymore who's thick as pig shit. The 5 months his blind, hair-lip, one-legged, premature baby with the mind of an eggplant spends in intensive care when it should have been thrown out with the bathwater. Not to mention the billions of dollars his wife's terminal cancer costs before she kicks the bucket anyway, since nobody in this country can die anymore without dragging the entire economy down with them.
Now, your father was a minister, is that right? Your father is Donald Shriver, who's a well-known theologian and was for a while the president of Union Theological Seminary. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That was not just a total non sequitur. I actually want to hear a little bit about how this kind of anger came up in you. Did conversations like the one you just read occur at your dinner table?
Oh, hell no.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe my anger comes from being dragged to church by the hair at the age of 12. You know, my publicist is constantly putting this stuff about my father being a minister and president of a seminary in my publicity material, and I wish she wouldn't. It's not that I'm not proud of my father. It's nothing like that. But it always makes me sound kind of prissy and moralistic and heavy, and it's as if I'm didactically telling you what to do. And actually, the truth is that I'm a natural heretic. I'm very rebellious and anti-authoritarian, and even on the moral level, it's true that I fancy my books secretly have moral content, but I'm mostly interested in the hard case. So the last, I mean, yes, my father's a minister, but the last thing I want my books to be is preachy.
But, you know, I wasn't suggesting they were at all. I'm just wondering if, because he wrote a lot of books himself. Did you?
Yeah, nonfiction.
Yeah. How did his role as a writer and a thinker and an author influence how you identified as a writer and a thinker and an author? You actually wrote a very nice, nuanced column about this in the Guardian, about how you actually inherited more of his characteristics than your brother. Did he talk about writerly, authorly things together?
A little bit. I think I especially owe him for a number of things. The fact that actually both my parents wrote books made the writing of books seem like a possible and ordinary thing. That's always nice. I grew up in a very political household, so ideas were part of the currency of the dinner table. I am incredibly grateful to my parents for having good grammar. That's made a huge difference to my life. And furthermore, not only do they speak in complete sentences and know the difference between like and as and who and whom, do you? but they also exposed me to a large vocabulary when I was young. They didn't talk down to us. And so, you know, when I was growing up, it wasn't just all cat, go, it, say, right? It was, you know, I can't even think of any long words now. Obviously wasted.
That's because you're in L.A.
But it, you know, that made a big difference. That made a big difference to me because I believe that there's a way in which you learn words when you're a kid that you never learn them as an adult. You don't completely internalize them. And I know that when I learn words as an adult, on the rare occasion I learn new words, because it doesn't happen very often, I have to almost recite a little definition beside it when I use it, whereas the words that I learned when I was 9 or 10 are with me for life. So, you know, speaking well was a huge favor that my parents did for me.
I wanted to ask you not only about the names of your characters, but first about your name, because according to not your publicist, but
not this again,
ever reliable Wikipedia, you were actually born Margaret Ann Shriver.
Oh, go ahead, tell them.
Is that correct? So where did Lionel come from? Did you have a preternatural affection for Lionel Hampton or
no.
Trains?
I just didn't like my name. And apologies to my parents. I'm sure they really liked that name, and I just think they should have had another kid and given it to her. I just always felt they were talking about someone else. And my parents moved the family from Raleigh to Atlanta when I was 15 years old, and I figured that was my chance. And I honestly picked Lionel out of the air. I didn't know anyone from whose name was Lionel. I'd never heard of Lionel Trilling. I'd never even heard of Lionel Trains. So that for years after I changed my name, people would come, would get introduced and say, "Oh, you mean like the trains?" And I'd look blank. I have a lot of affection for my name. I could give you advice if you do want to change your name. The main thing is to do it early and stick with it. And the nice thing in the modern era about my name is it turns out, I mean, if the internet is to be believed, there isn't another Lionel Shriver in the world. I think that's so cool.
For the moment. You're going to become so famous, people are going to be naming their kids after you, like Barack Obama or something like that. So there will be a spate of them. We have to take questions in a couple minutes, but I do want to talk about, we need to talk about Kevin just for a minute. I think a lot of people have the idea that you kind of burst onto the scene in 2003 when that
novel came out. Yeah, a lot of people think that was my first book.
And in fact, it was your eighth?
Depends on whether you count the one I didn't publish before it. Yeah, but really, it was my eighth book.
Yeah, you'd really been at it for a long time. And in fact, is it true that we need to talk about Kevin was rejected by like a lot of publishers, and there was really, it was very difficult to actually get
it. Yeah, it was hard to get that into print.
So, and it finally gets published and it wins the Orange Prize. How vindicating was that?
Very vindicating. It was great.
Were some of your novels published in the UK? Do I have that right?
There were a couple books that were exclusively published in the UK, and for an American author, that was a bitter pill.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it about your work that you think, what made Kevin sort of make the leap? Was that the first book that really took on a kind of current events sort of issue?
Or? No, no, no. Actually, I've always thought that my breakout book should have been Gain Control, which was my fourth novel. And its main character is a demographer. It's a hugely issues book. It's about a plot to kill 2 billion people overnight. and it deals with demography and asks the question about whether AIDS is going to kill enough people to take care of the population situation. When it was published, population had kind of slid off the map, and now it's back on. So that book is as timely as ever. And so why did Kevin hit it and Game Control didn't? I don't know. I'm not convinced it's the quality of the book. I think it's just the roll of the dice. Somehow it struck a nerve at the right time. And it was really in the UK that it took off. I don't know why. But for some reason, everyone was all ready to talk about motherhood in particular and was willing to start talking about whether it was really so great.
And you've become a kind of de facto spokesperson for the childless by choice community.
Yeah, which I did not choose. I mean, I decided not to have kids. That's not a political campaign. It's an individual decision. And there were some people who were going to stick me with this notion that women should just stop having children. And I'm a misanthrope, but I'm not that bad.
On that note, let's hear from you guys. There's somebody down here.
Oh, microphone. Oh, goodness. It's going to turn. There you go. Okay. Hi. I was curious if you have had any personal... I hate this thing. Sorry. Can you hear me?
We're recording.
It's for podcasts, yeah.
All right. Sorry. Sorry, podcasters. Have you had any personal experience with end-of-life or long-term caregiving? If so, how that informed the story, and if not... what were your primary influences in writing that aspect of the story, whether it was your friend or other people? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's, in terms of end-of-life caregiving, with my friend who had mesothelioma, I guess my experience was that I wasn't involved enough. One of the things that I address in this novel is the way in which, if you don't watch yourself, you'll end up avoiding people who are sick because it's uncomfortable to be around. It reminds you of the side of life you'd rather forget. It makes you nervous on your own account, and it also makes you feel a little helpless and inadequate. It's hard to know what to say. I was interested in the fact that the Washington Post review that was published today addressed this. The reviewer, Ron Charles, gets into in the end of the review the fact that he himself was remiss with somebody that he was very close to. And I'm afraid that this is commonplace. With my friend, I didn't disappear on her. I just didn't contact her enough. I didn't visit enough when I was in the States, and I didn't make enough special trips to the States. She was one of my best friends. And most of all, I just didn't pick up the phone often enough. It was like, oh, you should ring Terry. Oh, I got the printer cartridge needs replacing. I'll do it tomorrow. You know that. And in retrospect, I'm appalled. You know, why was I not more attentive? And why did I allow myself to shy from her? So that's part of what I was working through in the novel. And I'm afraid that if her husband's reaction immediately following her death is anything to go by, I was not the only one who was less than attentive. In fact, it was really horrifying to listen to, actually. The day after she died, her husband talked to me at length. And he was seething. He was so angry. And at everyone. He hated the whole human race. He was just overflowing. I mean, talk about misanthropy. That was the real thing. I have decorative misanthropy. and I think it was because this thing of people just not being there. It was universal. And it wasn't only just friends. It was her family. Her own mother only came to visit once in a year and 3 months of illness. Can you believe it? Her sisters only came to visit once. I was horrified. And I'm afraid that this is widespread. We don't know how to do illness in this country anymore, much less do we know how to do death. We don't know how to be kind to each other in these circumstances.
It's that you have that great line where you say, somebody says, well, I would have called, but it seemed like things were really bad for you.
Yeah, I'm done.
And how often have we had that thought? Well, I don't want to call because it seems like they're really upset. Seems like you're really sick. So I'll leave you alone.
Right.
That's an instinct.
Thank you for a lovely reading. I really enjoyed the reading.
Thank you.
In terms of what you just said about where you don't deal with death very well, I think that's a big part of it. You kind of put it on the medical profession that people are sort of pandered to live a long life and extend it. But if the people demand it, and there's a reason for that. They don't want to face
it. It's a symbiotic relationship. I totally agree. And, you know, I found writing this book useful for me to reflect on these things. I'm increasingly convinced I don't want to live a really long life. I want to live a good short life.
Hi, I'm just wondering why you've been living in London for so long. And also, do you cross paths with a lot of English authors? Do you sort of drop in for tea with Martin Amis and, you know, discuss ideas?
Unfortunately, Martin hasn't asked me over recently. Though I have to say, I like Martin Amis. I mean, I don't know him, but I like a lot of his work, and I'm one of the only people in Britain who ever sticks up for him. They treat him atrociously. I ended up in Britain a bit by accident. I originally moved to Belfast to write my third novel, Ordinary Decent Criminals. I was intending to live there for 9 months, and I stayed for 12 years in Belfast. I got very involved in Belfast, grotesquely involved in the politics, though I always feel I have to add, especially if I'm talking to somebody who's British, do I detect your accent correctly? That I was not in Gerry Adams' hip pocket. In fact, I was one of the only American unionists on the island of Ireland. And then my then partner got a job in London, so I moved with him. He'd stuck Belfast for 6 years, and I owed him. We subsequently have parted amicable ways, but that left me in London. And I don't know, I'm used to it there. I'm used to being an expat. I think it suits me. I've always felt about a little bit of an outsider, and I think I like it when that status is formalized. I've never kidded myself that I'm anything but an American in Britain. I know that's the way I'm regarded, and I don't think of myself as some kind of honorary Brit. But I like, for example, having a sense of involvement in a whole other country, which also involves me in Europe. Whereas when I come back to New York for the summer, I suddenly read less of European news, am less involved in it. There's something about the geographical thing. It's very powerful. And having more than one world, I really like, because I go back and forth between New York and London. I like the two universes that I keep going. At the same time, I'm incredibly lazy, and it's very important that both those universes speak English.
Hello. I'm sorry. I wanted to say I enjoy your books very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tonight's reading. Returning to the topic of terminal illness, most people, like you say, want to extend their lives at whatever cost possible. But there is the issue of assisted suicide, and most people don't really refer to it or quietly think about it. But what are your opinions on it and thoughts?
I'm all for it. You know, I think that it is a human rights issue. You own your own life. If you want to end it, you should have the right to end your life. And it's a big issue in Britain right now, because it's illegal to help somebody to die. And so people who have had enough and are usually in a lot of pain are having to go to Switzerland to go to this clinic called Dignitas. And technically, if you help someone to go to Switzerland to die, then you are criminally culpable. And so far, British authorities are not prosecuting, but they won't clarify the law sufficiently to make it so that, you know, your spouse or can go with you and be sure that they're not going to be arrested, right? So I think that's something that should be clarified. The chances of this country being especially liberal on this matter are small, but I do. I think you have a right to end your life if you want to, and if you make that decision, why shouldn't you be able to avail yourself of medical technology that makes that departure as graceful and painless as possible?
I think there was a case in Florida that involved a crippled paraplegic woman. I forgot her name. Was it Schiavo? I forgot her
Carrie
name.
Carrie Schiavo.
Carrie Schiavo. So what would be your opinion or attitude towards that case? That's just something that came to my mind, because their euthanasia was, I think, was it employed, or I think they denied it to her. I'm not even sure exactly what the...
Well, of course, Terri Schiavo was a national hoo-ha. And by the way, I did sneak Terri Schiavo into the book.
She doesn't talk, though.
No.
Right, no. Okay. It's not. I mean, it's a novel. Sorry.
Oh, I was definitely of the pull the plug on Schiavo brigade. Wouldn't you figure that? And one of the issues I raise in the book, because this is a book hugely about money, is that someone like Terri Schiavo cost a fortune. And you see, if you add up how much we probably spent in the state legislature, in Congress, in the courts, in addition to what she cost medically, it's outrageous. You know, that was millions, if not tens of millions of dollars spent on one woman who was already dead. And I just think that's wasteful. We can't keep doing this, right? Because you can take the same money and improve people's lives who are still here.
I have a question about process, because your writing is all over the universe. I mean, there's game control in Africa, there's dismantling bombs in Belfast, and
you read ODCs.
And an Armenian lady assembling greeting cards in the Midwest someplace. And I'm wondering if every book is a unique project, or just throughout your life you clip and save bits of information that are of interest and may come into play at some future time, or do you just dive into what you're doing at the time and gobble up as much information as you can in one fell swoop? Are you working on one novel at once, or are you just collecting a life of information?
Yeah, one novel at a time, for sure. But I do at least vainly imagine that each of my books is very different. And I've never wanted to be someone who just churns them out with slight variations. I've never wanted to be one of those authors who ends up imitating themselves. And I've never been especially attracted to writing sequels. So, I get very involved in one book and one set of materials. And sure, you know, like any writer, I pick up bits and pieces and in the course of my normal life and think, oh, maybe I'll use that. For years, for example, I was following snooker in Britain just for she's laughing. I was a snooker fan, but I didn't know what to do with it. And then when I wrote my last book, The Post-Birthday World, and I needed an exotic and very British profession for one of my leading men, I thought, snooker, I can finally use it. So that's the way it works.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the writing process. Do you outline your books? Do you know where they're going? And also, are you a person that sits down for a certain amount of hours during the day? Or, you know, do you have a routine? And by the way, Jane Byrne, your publicist, is my friend, so I'll tell her, you know, about your dad.
let's skip the other two questions and let's just talk about Jane. I love Jane. writing process. I always plan my books out ahead of time. It's not a prescription. There are lots of other writers who don't and wonder what happens next and think that the way I do things ruins all the fun. But as far as I'm concerned, it saves me a lot of bother. I like to conceive books in an almost sculptural way. And I also, you know, I want to have a sense of direction. I want to know what I'm writing toward. And therefore, I need to know what that ending is. I'm often amused that people ask me about Kevin in particular. Did you know the ending? Did you know? Well, how could you possibly have written that book without knowing the ending? You know, what happened? I don't want to give it away, but... So, yeah. I mean, as for how many hours a day I write, I often get asked this, and I don't understand why. Why do you care?
Because we want to feel really bad about ourselves in comparison to you.
I get the work done, you know, and sometimes I write for several hours, and sometimes I have another tedious piece of journalism due, and I do that instead. But you know, there's no special formula. You just put in the hours wherever you find them.
Well, we're very glad you did. And thank you so much for coming tonight, Lionel. Thank you all.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.